From the McGill Daily and CKUT, this is Unfit to Print. My name's Nico Block. I'm the features editor here at the Daily. There are a couple of articles in the current issue of the Daily that I just want to mention before we get going. We've got a news story about some of the strengths and weaknesses of the city's plans on homelessness and public housing. There's also a feature about indigenous resistance to open-pit mining in Panama, and a really outstanding article in the sports section about the plan to bring the Nordiques back to Quebec, and how that would essentially be a huge cash grab for the CEO of Quebec's right-wing media conglomerate, Quebecor. It's really interesting stuff, and if you can't get a copy of the paper, you can, of course, visit our website at mcgilldaily.com. Okay, so for today's program, we've got an interview with Adam Gopnik, who is a regular contributor to the New Yorker magazine. He just came out with his second children's novel. It's called Steps Across the Water. The book tells the story of a young adopted girl in New York City named Rose, who discovers a mystical portal to a super New York called UNORC. UNORC has skyscrapers, but they're 10 times as tall. Its limos drive up the sides of buildings, its cabs are enormous pigeons, etc. When Rose arrives, UNORC is in danger, and Rose is the only one who can save it. But it won't be easy. So our coordinating culture editor, Ian Beattie, talked to Gopnik for almost an hour on Friday, but he messed up with the voice recorder and had to call him back the next day at the Queen Elizabeth Hotel. So here's that interview.
Merci de votre appel. Thank you for calling. Tous nos agents sont présentement occupés. Veuillez demeurer en ligne afin de garder votre priorité d'appel.
Service Royal, merci d'avoir appelé Fermoine René Elizabeth. Oh, yes, how may I help you?
Hi. I'm wondering if you could put me through to the room of Adam Gopnik.
D-O-B?
G-O-P-N-I-K.
Absolutely, we'll put you through. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Celebrate your successes.
Hello?
Hi, can you hear me?
Hi. Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Okay, great. I tried to kind of twist the questions from yesterday a little so we won't be having the same conversation over again.
Okay.
But yesterday we started with UNORC and the cities, and I was wondering if you could just maybe identify for me what the qualities are of cities that attracts you to them and how they're reflected in New York. Like, what is it about cities that you love?
And how they're reflected in the real New York or in the imaginary UNORC?
I guess both. Well, in the book,
okay.
UNORC.
It's funny you mentioned. I was just thinking as we were. I was driving or taking a taxi back from dinner last night.
Yeah.
And we went by an old store in Montreal that just sells coins, rare coins. I remember it from years ago, and I think it's three things. It's density. It's the way that every imaginable merchant is crowded in, and particularly, and it's one of the things I love about New York, the density of weird stores, eccentric retailing, things that people are able to make a living buying and selling unusual things, so that the Lower East Side used to be packed with used bookstores and secondhand record stores and little pierogi dens and so on.
Okay.
So density, first of all,
mm-hmm.
and density in living, which has its frictions, but also means that on any one floor of a New York apartment building, every imaginable kind can be found. And then humankind can be found. And then plurality, the sense that there is that kind of variation. And then the sense of possibility. Cities provide us, maybe in a completely illusory way, with an enormous sense that there are many possibilities out there, that we can remake our lives. The classic thing in city fiction is that the hero or heroine starts in the belief that they can remake their lives, as in, you know, Balzac's Lost Illusions, and then finds out that they can't remake his life, or at least the way his life gets remade is even worse than the way it was before. But I think those three things, density, plurality, and possibility, are what we love in cities. And in New York, of course, those are all features of New York. In New York, the imaginary city, it has unbelievable density. It has great plurality, but its possibilities turn out to be a bit foreclosed. That's part of the story.
Yeah. And also, the fantasy of New York is one of the possibilities of New York in the book. Right?
Yes, yeah. That's true. I had not thought of it quite that way, but yes, that's so.
Yeah. Okay, and maybe if we could get back to the notion of how your book demonstrates maybe the fragility of the city. And yesterday you drew kind of a bit of an allusion to the event of 9/11 as kind of the background for your book.
Yeah, it's hard for me to recapture all that flowing eloquence a day later. But yeah. I think I was saying was that I, though I wasn't fully conscious of it and it wasn't part of the intentional structure of the book, I became acutely aware after the book was finished that the book was very much about the fragility of seemingly substantial things. And that, as inevitably happens when you're writing anything, the spirit of the time left its mark on it. The atmosphere of the moment leaves a scent. And in this case, it was the experience all of us had after 9/11, that what looked to us as brutally substantial a thing as it ever existed was, in truth, incredibly fragile and endangered. And I suspect that what is in a certain way the central image in this book, I don't want to give it away for kids, but I guess not too many kids read the Daily, of a great city caught in an incredibly fragile glass bowl that in some way, not fully intended, is an image of New York now.
And as children's literature, how do you think children relate to catastrophe and disaster on that scale?
I think, children seek instant reassurance. They seek meaning. They are much more resilient than we are. I don't know if you've ever seen the wonderful John Borman film, Hope and Glory, about a little boy living through the London Blitz. And what makes the film audacious and wonderful is the little boy's having a fabulous time. So it's thrilling for the little boy, but the world around him is coming apart. And my own sense is the kids who lived through 9/11, at least that's the sense I get from my son and his generation, though they were frightened, and they were frightened above all by their parents' fear, don't have it haunting them in some fatal way. It's part of the shape of the world they know, very much as for my generation. Fear of nuclear war, the presence of nuclear weapons, so it was very much part of what shaped us. And I lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis when I was about the same age as my son was at the time of 9/11, and I was scared because my father was scared. Nonetheless, it wasn't something that haunted me. It was simply something that was part of the universe, the moral universe that we all inhabited. So I think that catastrophe and disaster are necessary, as I was trying to say last night, as part of the equipment of children's literature. But you can't write, I don't think you can write an effective children's book without any threat in it. Threat is part of life, and it's one of the things that fascinates children. But, as I say, I think that the story is not just kids overcoming the threat, but kids learning to deal with it in a temperamentally even way. I put this much better yesterday, Ian, but it's the closest I can come now.
One of the things we didn't talk about yesterday, but which you mentioned in your talk, was contempt in children's novels, the child hero has to feel contempt for adulthood in some way. Mm-hmm. I just wondered if you could maybe explain why that's so important and why children's literature teaches children to feel that.
Well, as I was trying to say, kids are powerless for the most part even in a privileged and abundant society like ours. Kids are, by nature and culture, both powerless. And what do powerless people have in any circumstance? They have the knowledge of their own superiority to the people who are oppressing them. And I think that it's, that as I was trying to say last night, I think attempts to find some kind of strange, transgressive subversion in children's literature are mistaken, because it's not the overt content of the books. It's not a mistake with science fiction, but it is, I think, with the classics of children's literature. I'm digressing here, but it seems to me that one of the things that you find again and again, that's the real sort of roughage, the real tannic acid of children's literature is that almost every hero and heroine in children's literature shows a great deal of contempt for the grown-up world around them. The parents are either impotent or removed, and the authority figures are absurd.
Mm-hmm. Come back later, please.
And the authority figures are absurd. And so I think that that's the kind of other term in children's literature that keeps it or tries to keep it from being too sweet or too saccharine, is the presence of that kind of contempt. And it's one of the things children recognize, because they understand that they are not in their nature likely to have a great deal of power of action, but they have the power of acidic disdain for the authority figures around them.
But it also seems that feeling...
Hold on one second, Ian.
Sure.
You come back later, please. Thank you.
Sorry, go ahead.
No problem. It also seems like that feeling of contempt, though, it's also the beginning of children adopting some agency for themselves, right? It's when you kind of displace the parent as the locus of authority, you begin to understand kind of your own sense of responsibility.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think that's what happens in Steps Across the Water, is that Rose... is dissatisfied with the world around her, and she discovers that she does have agency. She didn't expect to have it, but she does have it, and that's part her arc in the story.
Yeah. And maybe one last thing. As we were talking yesterday about how you thought it is important for adults to engage with and read children's literature, because you said, you know, it's literature for anybody, really. But I was thinking that when we actually... there's kind of a difference in the position of the critic, because, mm-hmm. well, for one thing, when I was reading your book, I felt somewhat inadequate as a critic because I didn't have the perspective of the child reading the book, you know, so mm-hmm. I'd say, like, I don't know if this is actually going to work or not work for a child. So maybe critics of children's literature are placed in a kind of special position in that they have to sway to the popular opinion a little more than critics of adult literature, because really children engage with whatever they're going to engage with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think, look, there are always sort of territorial critics in any specialized field, you know, who you know, want to protect it from outsiders. And then there are critics, critics are just readers. And we all read just differently enough to get something, to take something odd out of, take something original out of a book. And it's what I was trying to say yesterday, and really is simply that I don't see a great vast difference between children's literature and other kinds of imaginative literature, and I don't see a great difference between children as readers and the rest of us as readers. It's just a tradition that enables you to do certain kinds of things. And as I hope I said yesterday, I think the smartest thing ever said about children's literature was Mitch Hedberg's line, you know, that all literature is children's literature if the kid can read. But there's this particular line and tradition that I love for its own sake, not just because it works for kids, because I love it, comic mythology. Maybe that's the way of putting it. You know, mythologies with a comic turn, which is different than, you know, science fiction, which tends to be mythology with a very dark turn. So I love mythology with a comic turn. And one of the places, maybe the chief place you find it in our literature, is in children's books. And I think that's why I love them, and that's why I love to write them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I was just thinking, it's funny that it seems to be one of the hallmarks of great children's books is that the critics hate them when they come out, and they predict their disaster. Like, it happened with Stuart Little, and then with the Harry Potter books, they're much maligned, but at the same time, they get gobbled up by kids.
Yes, I think that's true, but because they touch some imaginative region, or that continues to appeal to not just kids but to people of all kinds, whereas the books that get routinely praised tend to fit within the received territory of children's literature in a more obvious way. But you know what? That's true about grown-up books as well.
Yeah, and it's funny that they actually had to come out with adult covers for Harry Potter, so that
to make it work. So I think that's, you know, I think that's.
So that was Adam Gopnik, author of Steps Across the Water, and he was being interviewed by Daily Culture editor Ian Beattie. And the music you're hearing right now is the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble, who will be playing at Sala Rosa the night of November 4th. Hope you enjoyed the show. This has been Unfit to Print. I'm Nico Block.